This is the Rise Up See Red podcast, all about the Arizona Cardinals and the NFL, featuring insider and outsider perspectives. Enjoy the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Now here are your hosts, Jess Root and Seth Cox.
Hello, Arizona Cardinals fans, and welcome to the latest edition of the Rise Up See Red podcast. This is your host, Jess Root, from CardsWire.com, the NFL wire site covering the Arizona Cardinals, from the USA Today family of sites. My co-host is Seth Cox from RevengeOfTheBirds.com, ESPN Nation's Arizona Cardinals sites. And goodness, we're excited in this show, episode 284. Episode 284 is the episode that we are on, so that's one. We're closing in on 300 shows, Seth, but we are coming off something seemingly historic for us because the Cardinals beat the Seahawks at home and did it in the most unlikely of ways against, of all the teams that the Cardinals could, of all the Seahawks teams the Cardinals could have beaten at home, to beat this team like that is amazing.
Yeah, it is, and it's one of those situations where we just haven't seen that from the Seahawks, not the Cardinals' perspective. We've seen wonky, wild kind of – I mean, we saw it last year in the Lions game where they, you know, seemingly found a way to come back from an improbable, you know, deficit and – well, that was a tie, but this year to see, you know, them make a comeback that's, you know, 255 straight games where a team has a lead by 10 with less than 3 minutes to go and wins, and the Cardinals snap that. I mean, it's just not something that happens very often, and when you have – but when you have a team that believes in their direction and believes in, you know, their coaches and each other, you can really overcome anything. And I thought we saw that this week, and I think we're seeing some maturation out of players and even coaches, that while the win is incredibly exciting, I think the other things that we're seeing come out of this is even more exciting for what the future will be.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about in this edition of the show. We will talk about what this win does. What does it prove? Now that the Cardinals are 5-2 going into the bye, they have two division wins, they beat Seattle at home. What does it prove, if anything? We're going to talk about it felt like the Cardinals seemed to win. The Cardinals got the win in spite of Cliff Kingsbury's in-game decisions. And we're going to talk about the defense, the turnaround they had in the second half of the game, and just how somehow things turned around. Unfortunately, the win did not come without some cost, as there were some costly injuries in that game. We'll discuss that. And with the trade deadline coming up, we will discuss the possibility of adding to their roster. So that's coming up in this edition of the show. Let's go ahead and start off with this topic of what does the win prove? So the Cardinals, they started the year beating a San Francisco team that, if we look at their season so far, it's hard to read them. And you kind of look at that team as saying, you know, Kyle Shanahan's one heck of a coach, because you've got a team that keeps getting injury after injury. Then their defense looks terrible. And then they do what they did to the New England Patriots. They're now 4-3 on the season. They get an opening season win there. They take care of business against Washington. And then they sort of, they have a hiccup. A bad hiccup against the Panthers. They have a disappointment against the Lions, and then do what they needed to go against the Jets, and then you go on to the Seahawks, and this is, you're like, hey, this is this is their first kind of real test. I mean, we thought the beginning of the year that the 49ers game was going to be a real test. Then we saw how they started, and we're like, oh, maybe that wasn't it. But against a 5-0 Seattle team that was the highest scoring offense in the entire league, to come in and then, you know, fall behind the way they did, then to come back, this sort of feels like, and I hate being a prisoner of the moment, but this is the sort of win that defines a season for a team that has not yet found itself, and it's kind of at the finding itself game, because they came down from a deficit against a very good opponent. They overcame mistakes and questionable decisions and won. It feels like the end of 2013. That's the kind of in terms of that comparison, when they figured out ways to win, and then they started believing it. They got a couple of those losses out of the way, and they realized what it takes for them to win. And now they believe they can do it. And I believe that moving forward, now the bye's coming at a good time, they're 5-2, which is, I think, better than what any of us predicted they would be at this point. I think 4-3, I think. I'd have to go back. We have to go back to the show. I don't remember what I picked, but 5-2, 4-3, they're ahead of schedule. They've got two very winnable games at home coming after the bye, because Miami, it kind of works out perfectly. They're going to be playing the Dolphins after their bye, one. And two, it's after the Cardinals were able to get a game worth of tape on Tua, who is making his first NFL start this weekend. And so the Cardinals will be able to prep for that. Then they play a Buffalo Bills team that offensively they can do some things, but defensively they just, you know, they don't stop the run very well. They could be going into the Thursday night game in Seattle 7-2, and with a chance to sweep the season series against the Seahawks at a stadium where they have had uncanny success. It feels like a team that is, if I have to look at last year's 49ers team, I think they are turning into that team. Not to say that they're going to go 13-3 and go to the Super Bowl, but I think they are defining themselves in a way that they're just going to keep winning even when you don't think that they will.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations where you look at it and you see that they're doing it in a lot of a different way than San Francisco did last year. Obviously, they're not as, you know, defensive focused, but in the same way, they are a team. You know, you look at it. You know, they're still 10th in scoring points. They've gone up to 9th. Or sorry, they're 10th in scoring defense. They've gone up to 9th in scoring offense. So that's right where we expected them to be offensively. They're, you know, second in yards offensively in the NFL, which, I mean, that's really good. They're, you know, they're probably the best rushing offense in the NFL, even though they're second in yards and third in yards per attempt. But I would venture to say they're probably the best pure run offense in the NFL. And the fact that they're 12th in passing is actually, or sorry, 15th in passing is actually pretty impressive when you look at how effective they are running the football. And so, you know, a lot of that all comes in to they're putting themselves in a position to be successful. And that was just something, you know, last year that San Francisco did so well. You know, like you said, they're a team that you can win in multiple ways. Obviously, you know, the San Francisco defense was a little more ferocious, I guess, for lack of better terms. They had a little more, they had a little higher end talent on the defensive line, especially, but what the Cardinals have been able to do so far is just be opportunistic on defense, which is something that they haven't done really since the Todd Bowles era. I mean, if we went back and looked at the James Betcher Arizona Cardinals defense, I think the thing that we would lament is opportunities missed. Whereas right now they do have that kind of let down once or twice a game, and in this case the first four drives of the game or something of that nature. But they find a way to rally, and they find a way to put themselves in a position to win. And this is what I wanted to talk about, you know, mostly during the game, because there was a lot of hand-wringing over how the game was managed at the end. And we'll get to that. But I want to get to in the fourth quarter and the decisions that they made to continue to run the ball effectively with, I think they got the ball back in the fourth quarter with what, 6 minutes to go about?
Yes.
And they ran a really effective, you know, basically a 3 minute offense to get down and get into field goal range. Now, remember, they were down 10, so they needed a field goal and a touchdown still. Order didn't really matter. And they were going to obviously attempt the field goal. And Benson Mayoa, former Arizona Cardinal, planting him on the Seahawks defense finally paid off, apparently, because he got the unsportsmanlike conduct penalty, which resulted in a 15-yard. Now, I can't remember off the top of my head. Does that automatically give you a first down, or was it only because of the yardage? Okay, so it wouldn't have mattered. They would have gotten a first down. It was 4th and 12, so they would have gotten first down with anyways. But then they, you know, now they're at the 19, and two plays later, they're in the end zone. And so, and people were really kind of perplexed by that drive. So they got the ball back with 6 minutes and 44 seconds left after a touchback, on what was, you know, before that, just an probably improbable is the best way to put it, touchdown pass and catch by Russell Wilson to Tyler Lockett. And you know, everybody rightfully probably thought, oh, that's game. 34-24, 6:44 left. And Cliff comes out and runs the ball, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 plays in a row, throws 1, 2 short passes, runs the ball again, throws another short pass again, and then you get 2 incomplete passes trying to get a little more yardage, and now all of a sudden you're in that, you know, field goal, and you know, the rest is kind of history. And people really lamented that. Well, you just took 4 minutes to score a touchdown. At the same time, what they did was they didn't allow Seattle to go into their normal offense. They made Seattle go into their 2 minute offense with the idea of, we have to get a first down. And Cliff played it really well at that juncture. We'll get to the other stuff later, but at that juncture, and I thought relied on what this team does well, which is they mix up the run and pass, but they're a really good team at running the football. They do it incredibly effectively and incredibly efficiently. And I think we've seen a number of times when the Cardinals become one-dimensional, that they're not as effective. And that we saw that in the Carolina game. So when you allow this team to be multiple offensively, you're going to see a team that's, you know, able to really put pressure on a defense and continue to move the ball efficiently and effectively. And I thought, you know, I thought that was more ballsy than anything, because it would have been really easy to been, you know, just be like, oh, you know what, we're just gonna try and throw the ball, and you know, if it doesn't work out, everybody would just kind of shrug their shoulders with that, right? They would have been like, oh, well, they just couldn't, you know, there wasn't enough time left. They didn't. But to go out and run your offense and stay in your offense, I think that just shows that Cliff understands where his strengths are offensively. And it did show that you trusted your defense. You didn't feel like you needed to score a touchdown with, you know, in a minute and then hope that, well, if we don't get a stop, maybe we'll just give up a field goal and have a chance to win it with a touchdown. You know, it kind of breeds this belief in the team. And that's what, I mean, that's what this team and organization needed. And you know, despite their best efforts at times, they came through in the end.
Coming up next on the Rise FC Red podcast, the best era of Cardinals talk on the web. We're going to move on and we're going to talk a little bit more about the decisions that Cliff Kingsbury made. And we'll kind of discuss, they were talked about at length after the game. So let's do that some more. I'm coming next on Rise FC Red. We're back on the Rise FC Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Seth already kind of gave us a rundown at late game strategy, but the decisions that Kingsbury made come down to a couple of scenarios. Now, I was nervous because it felt like, not necessarily that the run, I didn't have a problem with the running game. It just felt that when they got the ball back in ultimately for that, with that touchdown, it felt like they weren't playing with urgency, like it was okay to let time off the clock. And I was okay with the running. I just didn't like the pace. And I almost feel like they lucked into that, because they, if there isn't that penalty by Mayoa, they're down by seven. And so they get a few seconds back. And let's kind of look at what that would have ended up being. And so they would have given the ball back to Seattle instead. So they kicked it off away at 2.5 minutes, essentially. It would have been at 3 minutes. So they would have been down by seven with 3 minutes to go. And with everything else, that if everything remained the same after that, and they still get the ball back, rather than getting the ball back with 52 seconds, they get it back with about a minute 20. And I don't know if they are able to do a touchdown tying drive in that same thing. So I almost feel like it was, while I applaud them for continuing to go with their plan, I would have much more have liked to see them have moved with a little more urgency, because they kind of lucked into that first touchdown, which set up everything else. But I know what everyone wants to hear are our thoughts on the first half decision of Cliff to go for it on fourth down and goal after the Buddha interception instead of taking the points. And then, of course, at the end of overtime, that's the decision that led to what he called a complete debacle. But let's talk about that first decision. Buddha Baker picks off a pass. You know, Buddha, who had zero career interceptions in the regular season entering this season, now 2 weeks in a row, a primetime interception. This one he takes 90 yards, only to be caught from behind by DK Metcalf, saving a touchdown. That was a game save. What was a game changing play by Buddha and a game saving play by DK, especially with what happened after that, because they can't punch the ball in the end zone. And on fourth down, they decide to go for it instead of taking the points. And the play doesn't work out. They give the ball back to Seattle. And with no points. And unfortunately for the Cardinals at that point, they don't really capitalize. They don't capitalize on that, on what had happened after that. So that's kind of like the thing that was kind of odd, out of the entire thing. But lots of people were like, how can you not just take the points? For me, I had no problem with the decision because this is the coach that Kingsbury has been in the season and a half that he's doing it. Statistically, analytically, he's been aggressive on going for it in fourth down and in goal-to-goal situation. And if you look at the Cardinals' success leading up to that play at that moment, the Cardinals had been perfect in goal-to-goal scenarios and had been perfect on fourth down all season. And so it goes to show that the decision you should, based on past history and based on the philosophy you have as a coach, you have to go for it on fourth down there. Now, you probably should have a better play, or it didn't work out well at all. And so you can't base it on the result, but that's still a smart play. And you know, those 3 points would have been nice at the end of the game, but they didn't end up mattering. And you know, it was still in the first half when the defense wasn't doing any good, but you give them the opportunity, the defense to hold them, and then you flip field position. You at least took points off the board for Seattle initially, so that was a net positive to begin with. So I have zero problem with the decision to go for it, although personally I probably kicked the field goal because even though Cliff said 10 out of 10 he'd do it again against a team like Seattle, you're not going to be in with field goals. Personally, probably would have kicked the field goal, citing the fortunate turn of events, because in terms of, you know, momentum's not really an analytically or quantifiable thing. To go from that 90-yard interception, 90 return, to no points is a downer. And I think the defense kind of felt like that a little bit. And so instead of getting fired up, at least you kick a field goal. The defense is still coming off of that momentum. And while Seattle gained a little bit because they held them to only a field goal, I think it works out longer term. But in terms of what Cliff's done, that's Cliff's identity, and he's going to do that every single time. And so he should do that because that's him.
Yeah, and that's my philosophy too, is like you have to be the coach that you are. And you know, a lot of times it works out, and every once in a while it doesn't. But if you don't stay true to yourself, it leads to bigger issues. And it kind of, you know, I think we kind of saw that later in the game. And so, you know, you and I talked about it a little bit off the air, but that decision to go for it on fourth down there, I thought was the right decision. One, if you're playing a team other than Seattle and maybe Kansas City, trying to think of any others off the top of my head right now, but you know, Seattle and Kansas City probably are the top two teams in that instance. Maybe you are looking at it from a different perspective and you're like, hey, let's just get some points and get out. You know, that was good. Let's just get some points. But when you know that you're probably not going to be able to keep up with them, and there's a high likelihood that you won't be able to stop them consistently. Now, that's another conversation. I think you have to go for the points there, because every opportunity you get to score a touchdown against a team like Seattle, you have to take it. And let's be honest, they're red zone defense is porous at best. I think they were, 28th coming into the game? So, I thought it was the right call. I thought it was just bad play calls. I was surprised by the lack of motion until the last play call with Fitz. I was just surprised overall by how they came out in that series. I thought they would have been a little bit more aggressive, but it happens, and that's kind of life, and you learn and you live and you move on. And, you know, last week we talked about it a little bit. This offense and defense being equal is going to be a big thing for this team and their future moving forward. And that also means making the right calls and decisions offensively and defensively. At that point in the game, it was, I believe, what, 17-7 or something at that point?
It was 13-7 that turned into 20-7 after Seattle then took the ball down the field. And that's where that was the part where at the point you're like, oh, crap, they should have gone for the points because Seattle did just they went 95 yards on their own and scored a touchdown to go by 13. It almost felt like by a lot of people at that time, the game was over.
Right. And so, so 13-7, I do understand the idea of like, oh, you just got to get the points. But, and let's just say that it played out the next drive the same and Seattle goes down and scores, you're still down two scores. I get it's a touchdown and a field goal now, but you're still down two scores. And so, you know, whether you're down 10 or 13, in reality, it doesn't matter because you're, like I said, you're going to have to score touchdowns against this team. You're going to have to put touchdowns on the board. You know, field goals are just not going to be enough. And so I thought it was the right decision. I just think the play calling at that point was actually probably the worst it's been. For Cliff in the red zone, and it was just ended up being the worst it had been in that game too.
Now the big thing, this was the complete debacle. This is what leads up to the Cardinals get the ball back in overtime. Here's the sequence of events. So they get the ball back, they force a punt. So first of all, Seattle wins the coin toss, which you feel is a death sentence, especially the way that the way they moved the ball in the first half, the way that the Cardinals held them in the second half, and you almost felt like they can't keep this up. It's Russ. They're going to go down, but they get the punt. And the Cardinals just Swiss cheese their way down the field. You get Larry Fitzgerald for 7 yards. Chase Edmonds runs for 32 yards, then runs for 9 yards. Then Kyler runs for 6 yards. They get to the 20, they get to the 18-yard line, and they're cooking. Like, you know, using a term that Seattle fans like to do. The Cardinals are cooking offensively, and the Seattle defense is gassed. Then suddenly, Cliff, I don't know what made him decide this. Maybe it was because they were in position to win the game. They have a run play. They have a Kyler Murray run play that gets blown up, and they lose 5 yards. And it's like he tightened up. He got the lemon booty. And he's like, okay, we got to go for this kick. And so second and 15 with 2 minutes, it's about 3 minutes left in the game. There's clocks running. They bring the kicking team out to kick the game-winning field goal on second and 15. It's a 41-yarder. And then that looks like, so Gonzalez hits it. But the flag is thrown, and it looks like it's going to be a delay of game, which pushes back, so it's a mess already. But no, Cliff called a timeout, so he essentially iced his kicker. And then, of course, after the timeout, they go back out there, and then Zane misses the kick. And everyone is losing their mind because of what Cliff did. Cliff iced his kicker! How could you do that? Well, first of all, he had to. Otherwise, otherwise, they back him up another 5 yards again, and it's second and 20. And so that was the thing you have to do. But what really it comes down to is, what in the world was Cliff thinking? Was that one negative play that bad that he just like, oh, forget it, we're going to go for the now? Because it felt at that point, the way they were just cutting through the yards, all you have to do at that point is keep giving the ball to Chase. I'm not saying run Kyler. Give the ball to Chase. Give the ball to Chase until you get to fourth down, or until they stop you, or until you score a touchdown. Because it felt like they were gonna get a touchdown if they just kept running the ball, to leave no doubt. And for me, what made the most sense is don't settle and hurry and kick a medium long field goal at 41 yards with 2 minutes and 50 seconds left in the game when if you miss, you give them, you give Seattle the necessity. They only need to go about 40, you know, they only need to go about 40 yards and they have 3 minutes to do it to kick the game winning field goal. You know, at least if you run one more time, you cut that down another 40 seconds and you're a few yards closer. You've at minimum, at the worst case scenario, given Seattle a few more yards to go with a few seconds less. And I think that was the failure in what happened. It wasn't the timeout. It was just what spooked him.
Yeah, and it's one of those situations where I think earlier in the game, failing on that fourth down probably, like you said, puckered him up a little bit and made him uncomfortable. It didn't make sense from where they were on the field. That's just the reality of the situation. It felt like after the timeout, I know you'd already decided, but send your offense back out there, run a play, at least run the ball once, run the ball twice, get into a little better position to then go back out and just kick it. It just seemed like you were at that point trying to force that decision of like, well, we had already decided to do it, so we might as well stay with it. You know, and in the end, it didn't hurt. It didn't kill them. It didn't, you know, change the outcome of the game. But it did concern me that Cliff would make a decision that way because we haven't seen that from him. Now, obviously, we haven't seen a ton of decisions he's had a chance to make where he's in a position to win a game. But we haven't seen that from him at all in his tenure in Arizona. And so to do it in a big game on Sunday Night Football against your division rival who, by the way, you haven't beat their quarterback since 2012 in your home stadium. And to make that decision to play scared, it didn't make any sense. If the offense had already been on the field and gone three and out, or, you know, through an interception, or, you know, whatever scenario you want, and they were struggling, or, you know, let's flip the sides and say that Arizona was in the position Seattle was in where they had blown the lead, you know, 10-point lead in the fourth quarter and decided to kick that field goal at that spot. I would get it because at that point, you're gassed. I mean, think about it from this perspective. The Cardinals were outscored 27-17 in the first half. They outscored the Seahawks 20-7 in the second half in overtime. So the reality was Arizona was fresher. You talked about it. They were moving the ball at will. It's not even like they were struggling to move the ball against them in the fourth quarter or overtime. I mean, they were literally just moving the ball at will. And to what it almost seemed like be panic was just odd. It, with how well your offense had played in the fourth quarter.
Well, especially think about they panicked in a scenario where they didn't need to win earlier when they got that touchdown. They were acting like they were acting chill when it was the time to move the ball with urgency. They weren't rushed. And they rushed to a decision in overtime. And maybe it was just, you know, the Seattle's comebacks have just we'll take it back a week. It was the silly sort of decision that that Minnesota made. It was a poor coaching decision that Mike Zimmer made to go for it rather than kicking the field goal to put them up and get them up by 8. So that at the worst they're going to tie. At the end of the game, there was another questionable coaching decision that gave Seattle an opportunity. Now, luckily, Isaiah Simmons with he happened to be in the game for one of the 5 plays he played, got the interception, and everything works out all right. But oh my goodness, let's hope Clips learns from this, because let's not have him put them in a situation to be in position to be in control and act like he's not in control. Because that's what it felt like. They made the decision to kick that field goal is because it's like they had barely grabbed control when they were clearly in control in that drive. They were cruising down the field. You know, it's 2nd and 15. You know, hand the ball off to Chase. Give him another chance. Even if you want to keep it on that left hash, run left. Run up the level, run left. You know, pick up 5-6 more yards, and then it's you know, it's 3rd and 8. You can run it again, and then if you end up with a 32-yarder with another minute and a half off the clock, perfect. But let's not do that again. And hopefully we never have to be in that scenario again where Cliff is in a position to lose the game for us, as opposed to have already been in that position where it was the players that got outplayed. So I don't like leaving decisions up to coaches like that, because, you know, maybe it was an experience in the NFL and maybe he has experience. I'd have to go back and look at his Texas Tech times. Did he lose games like that before when he pushed it, where he went for 2 extra plays too many? I don't know.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, I could definitely understand if they were struggling to move the ball offensively and you forced a turnover or, you know, had a long kick return or something, you know, and you were just in that position. But to be the guy that, you know, is so brazen and, you know, so aggressive so often, to come back with that just seemed odd. And like the moment all of a sudden, I don't want to say got too big for him, but was very real. Does that make sense? Like,
right.
Like all of a sudden it's like, holy crap, we can win this game. We better go win right now. Like, instead of being like, okay, we're in a great spot. Like, let's bleed this out. I mean, how many times have we talked about a team leaving no time on the clock and kicking? And they kicked the ball with, you know, 2:47. Yeah, so 2:42 on the clock when Seattle got the ball back. I mean, that's the weird thing to me is like there was just no reason to kick it at that point. And it just didn't, I mean, from a strategy standpoint, from a game flow standpoint, from everything else, literally every inch of momentum was on your side, and you played it like you had to kick it there or it was going to be, you know, you weren't going to be able to win it. That it just reeked of panic and desperation. And that's just not something we've seen from Cliff at all. But the fact that, you know, it happened in his first time in a game in that scenario was, you know, I think it's one of those things where if his response afterward wasn't so candid and so, you know, so authentic, at least it seemed like, that you would be more concerned than what you are today.
I do appreciate the way he responded and how, a lot of ways how, and I know some of the way he responds to things is deflects from his players, but he's like, oh, that's like, we won't do that again. Anyway, coming next on the Rise of the Sea Red podcast, the best of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's come back and talk about the defense, which was terrible in the first half and very good in the second. That's coming next on Rise of the Sea Red. We're back on the Rise Up Sea Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. The Cardinals gave up 377 yards of offense in the first half and 27 points. And it was that moment in that first half when everyone, we've been talking about the defensive metrics that the Cardinals have had. They're the number two scoring defense. They're doing great in the red zone. They're doing great on third down. They're doing great. They're doing pretty all right in yards. They're doing good at getting pressure on the quarterback. And then they're going against one of the league's most potent offense, the highest scoring offense, with one of the best yards producing offenses against a quarterback that, you know, has been the best. I don't think you can say that there's been anyone better than Russell Wilson through the first five games of the season. And that defense was just atrocious. And everyone's thinking, oh, yep, we knew it. We knew it was a mirage. But then it wasn't. And the second half comes around. Then they give up less than 200. So basically they cut the yardage. So first half, 377 yards. The entire second half and overtime is 195 yards. They basically cut their yardage allowed in half and only allow 7 points. They get two turnovers. They get the two sacks. They turn things around. And so the first half, so the initial reaction, of course, is we always knew this defense was bad to, oh, we forgot that the Seahawks have literally been doing this to every team in the league. And in the second half, they made adjustments. I don't know what to think of this defense now because we've seen against a good offense of them look awful and good. So what stood out to you about that defensive performance from the first to the second half? What went wrong initially and what went right after that?
You know, I don't think anything went right in the first half. Obviously, the Buda Baker interception, but I don't think they sacked Russ once in the first half.
No, they didn't get the first sack until late in the fourth, and it was a Hassan Reddick sack. It might have been overtime too.
Yeah, I think the first one was in overtime. Yeah, on that second down play, which was huge. You know, and that was the concern coming in was could they get Russ off his timing, because if you give him time, I mean, we saw what happened in the first half. I think the more concerning aspect was how little interest they showed in tackling Chris Carson. because I mean, I know he came out in, I think it was the third quarter he got hurt. I can't remember off the top of my head, but, you know, or maybe it was even earlier, but he only had 5 carries, but he had 34 yards. Carlos Hyde had 15 carries for 68 yards, and his touchdown run was one of those things that I was like, did we miss a whistle? Like, did a whistle occur? Like, why was the defense not aggressive on that? It was just
right. It was weird. It's like they got him to the sideline and then no one touched him. Did they think he was going to go out on his own?
Right. So that to me, because like you said, Russ and, you know, Metcalf and Lockett do that to everybody, except, you know, Metcalf had what, 17 yards receiving in the game. So
22, I think he ended up with a second catch in there somewhere.
Yeah, 23. But yeah. So, yeah, and one was 17 yards. So 2 for 23 on 5 targets. Patrick had an interception. You know, I thought they reasonably held their own, especially in the second half, against the Seahawks passing offense. The rush defense all game was definitely a concern. I mean, as obviously, you know, as fans of the Cardinals, we understand how hard it is to control and contain a quarterback that can run the ball like Kyler Murray, obviously, and Russell Wilson. But 6 carries for 84 yards, that's like Kyler at his best type of thing. That's not even that's not even a normal Kyler game. I mean, what Kyler had this game, 14 for 67, is a little more, you know, what you expect if he's going to run the ball. So, I mean, to basically give up 15 yards a carry to Russell Wilson, and don't get me wrong, like, he's phenomenal, and I get that, but they almost played it like he wasn't a threat to run. And and that was just odd to me. You know, obviously the first half was what it was when it came to trying to contain the passing game. I think you have to be cautiously optimistic about what you saw in the second half. Because obviously I guess that should not be an expectation, is the best way to put it, for an entire game from the defense against the Seahawks. I won't say against any team, but against the Seahawks, I don't think it'd be reasonable to expect them to play at that high of a level for four quarters, because like you said, nobody can. But I thought the fact that Vance did a really nice job of scheming pressure in the second half, he created different looks, gave Russell Wilson a lot of different looks in the second half. And I think those two things especially really created the opportunities the Cardinals had to come back in the game. I mean, again, they were down 27-17 at halftime. You know, Arizona got the ball to start the half. They punted. And that felt like a loss, did it not?
It did. Like, it absolutely felt like a loss.
Like, you came out, and it's 27-17. You get the ball. You march. I think they went about 25, 30 yards, and then you have to punt, and then you're like, oh, crap. And then, don't forget, Seattle's next, like, five plays were plus 13, plus 6, plus 10, plus 5. And then you finally saw two incompletions in a row, and you're like, okay. And then they punted, and for Arizona to come back and respond and go on. I mean, that was a really long scoring drive that Arizona went on. Obviously aided by a iffy at best, you know, unnecessary roughness penalty on Bobby Wagner. That was tough. And then they got another stop when Patrick intercepted DK, or when Patrick intercepted Russell Wilson for the second time in the game. And at that point, you felt like, okay, it's 27-24. The momentum has shifted. You know, you've got a chance. And then Kyler immediately throws an interception on literally the first play. And you're like, oh, crap. But then the defense did a really nice job again. You know, they got it down to fourth and two at the three. And, I mean, let's be honest. They played really good defense on that fourth down play. And Russell Wilson made a throw that probably only Russell Wilson can make. And Tyler Lockett made a catch that probably only Tyler Lockett can make. And Drake Kirkpatrick, I mean, was in great coverage, and it just didn't work. And so, the second half, to hold them to 7 points in basically three full quarters, since they almost played the full overtime, it was so impressive, and it shows you what they're capable of. It's just a question of, can that be something that they do on a consistent basis, and how consistent is it?
Well, right. And to think as well, because they were doing it without Chandler Jones, they lost Jordan Phillips, they lost Zach Allen. And so they were down their best edge guy, who was on injured reserve. And on top of that, they were down their best interior pass rusher. And so they were playing with only four defensive linemen. Corey Peters played a whole bunch. Lekki Fotu played a whole bunch. Angelo Blackson played his normal amount. and then Trevon Coley got playing time. And so they were playing more than they had to and still managed to do well. And doing it with a Hassan Reddick, an undersized Hassan Reddick for the position, and still playing well. I thought the defensive secondary played well. I know Drake Kirkpatrick, he had himself a rough night. Tyler Lockett's pretty dang good. And with Patrick locking down DK, you knew that Tyler Lockett was going to get a lot of targets. They limited the pass game to the backs and tight ends, which had been kind of a bugaboo. At least the backs especially had been kind of been a bugaboo for the Cardinals this year. And they've kind of fixed that. So Dre got picked on a lot. And Tyler Lockett is the type of receiver that will give him trouble. Dre covers guys better that are more like a DK. They'll kind of like Patrick. And so, you know, if this is what we have moving forward, I mean, you're going to go against a rookie quarterback making his second NFL start after the bye. Then you've got Josh Allen, who's wildly wild. he's been better, but he still makes really interesting decisions. And then you go back to Seattle. And so you've got the chance. You've got the chance for this defense to really establish itself as solid, which is going to be fun to see. And I can't wait to see it. Coming next on the Rise of the Secret Podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Let's talk about some of the costs of that game. There are a number of injuries that there are. How will that affect them moving forward? How costly are they? That's coming next on Rise of C-Red. We're back on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. The Cardinals suffered a number of injuries in that game. Two of them, you know, four guys who get playing time significantly. Obviously, the big one is Kenyon Drake. Late in the game, he goes down. It looks bad because he's carted off the field. You can see he's visibly upset. He's going to miss a few weeks. He didn't break his ankle. There's some ligament tearing. They're treating it like a high ankle sprain, but he's going to miss several weeks. Isaiah Irving was carted off the field. He's on injured reserve. Now, he's the special teams player. That affects that. Zach Allen injured his ankle early in the game. He ends up on injured reserve. Now, that's not the same thing as in previous years because you can be on injured reserve for only 3 weeks and come back off if that's the plan. Jordan Phillips left with a hamstring injury. Jordan Hicks left the game in the fourth quarter with an ankle injury. How concerned are you with these injuries? Let's talk about the Kenyon Drake injury. How bad or how prepared are they to handle this?
Yeah, I don't think there's a huge issue. Basically, because they didn't put him on the IR, and like you talked about, that's 3 weeks. So, you know, if it was serious where they were concerned, they probably would have IR'd him for, you know, and then he would have been eligible to return for the second, you know, the next Seattle game. And so I doubt he plays against the Dolphins. Let's put it that way. I would not be surprised if he played against the Bills, but I would be more surprised if he did not play against the Seahawks. Does that make sense? Like, I think obviously right now he's probably, you know, a 10% chance he's going to play against the Dolphins unless he just gets in the cryo chamber and then puts a walking boot on and literally does nothing but, you know, stretches and try to get that back to strength. I would say for the Miami game, the Buffalo game, he'll be a coin flip. It'll be one of those things where he'll probably be out of the boot and start working and we'll see where he's at. But they probably feel good enough about Chase Edmonds, and rightfully so. And they like, I mean, we know that they like Eno Benjamin and Jonathan Ward. So, and they still have DJ Foster, who, you know, is mainly a special teams guy for them, but they like him enough that they've kept him around for 1.5 seasons. I mean, they put him on the practice squad IR because they think of him as being valuable enough. So I'm not concerned about the Drake injury because there was no IR. If it comes out tomorrow that it's an IR, I'll be slightly more concerned because, I mean, ankles are a weird thing. Christian McCaffrey's been out, what, 6 weeks with an ankle? Five weeks with an ankle? So, I mean, they're weird animals. Everybody responds differently. But I think if it was a high ankle, we probably would have known that he was done at least until the Seattle game. Because, don't you feel like they would have put him on IR if it was like, oh, he's definitely not playing against Miami or Buffalo? I mean, I just feel like they left the door open more for the Buffalo game than the Miami game, but I'm not super concerned at this moment with Drake's injury just simply because they didn't IR him.
Yeah, there's that. And although I'm not convinced that they won't do it later this week anyway, because I think they tend to delay these moves unless they have to. And they already freed up some roster spots, so I don't know. They might be playing this funny because, like, they did it with Marcus Gilbert a year ago. You know, he injured the knee in practice on Friday. They knew he had a torn ACL, and they didn't put him on IR until week two. They'll like to play games with us. But, you know, it's a different scenario. Chase Edmonds, they've seen what he can do with a full load. And obviously he's played well enough that Cliff trusts him. And what we saw last year out of Drake is when he got his trust, he rode that. Like he kept Drake in the game and only brought it, could have got him out again when he needed a breather. This year, because of the way that Chase is playing, they haven't. They've had specific roles for both of them. And I believe after the trust that they have in him, that his role will be what Drake was a year ago. And so the guys behind him are just going to get, you know, breather spots where you might see Eno or Ward get between them 10 snaps, maybe. Because that's kind of how they roll. Now, the only issue becomes if then Chase gets dinged up, because that's the situation that they were in a year ago when DJ Johnson got hurt. And then after his performance against the Giants, where he scored the 3 touchdowns, he has the 7 carries or 8 carries against New Orleans, and his hamstring goes, and he misses. And that's exactly what led to the Kenyon Drake trade. So in terms of the running back, in fact, they might be better off because, you know, as good as Drake has been, he's been steady, and they've been good when they've needed him to be, especially in games. Chase has been dynamic in pretty much every way. He's been great in the run game. He's been great in the pass game. He's just made an impact in everything that he's done. And so getting him in the lineup, he's ready for this. And we've known this has been a thing that the Cardinals have believed, because ever since he was drafted, like, Steve Keim raved about the comps. Like he wouldn't even say on draft, like when he after drafted, he wouldn't say the player comp they have him for because the expectation is too great. Steve Wilks raved about him. They raved about him a year ago. They've raved about him in the offseason. So this, I think, is the chance for Chase Edmonds to shine, because I think the belief is in the organization that Chase Edmonds was going to be their guy next year anyway. So now we get to see it. Now it's just they have questionable depth. And so we'll see what happens. I don't think they will use their other running backs a whole heck of a lot. And I don't know if they even need to think about adding anyone as well. Maybe a veteran off the streets.
I was thinking maybe a practice squad guy. I mean, people know my opinion on running backs, so I don't want anybody to take this the wrong way. But, I mean, they're there to get used up and then let go. And I didn't agree, and again, not because he hasn't been productive or any of that nature. I don't want this to come across this way. I just didn't agree with signing Kenyon Drake to an extension. I just didn't agree with it at all. So the fact that he's injured now, not to his fault, not anything he did wrong, not anything, you know, like that. It just kind of goes to what I've always thought about running backs is – they're a replaceable commodity as long as your offense isn't geared towards them being the offense. You get what I'm saying? Like, in 2017, David Johnson wasn't replaceable because they had geared that offense towards him. And that, and, you know, we saw that, especially in the beginning of the year after he got injured, that they just couldn't find their rhythm. You know, you look at the Panthers this year, as good as Christian McCaffrey is, Mike Davis is doing enough to keep them afloat while he's out. And by the way, Mike Davis couldn't hack it with, I think it was the Bears. Yeah. And so, I mean, at the end of the day, running backs are guys that good ones are good to have. Great ones are great to have when you have them, but they're not – they don't change the game the way that they used to, where you can justify paying a great running back and getting – this, you know, similar production from a good running back. And that's just the reality of the position. And so, you know, if there was a name that intrigued me that you could get, I would be fine with that. And again, if Drake goes on IR, my opinion changes, because I think you then do need to make some sort of move, not like you did last year with Kenyon Drake, but I think bringing in just somebody that can, you know, that's a veteran that understands how to run would make more sense if Drake is done. And again, not the 3 weeks done, but like if he's done for the year done type of thing.
What is your level of concern with the other injuries? The Jordan Phillips, Zach Allen, Jordan Hicks. What is your level of concern with them? And for me, I would imagine Hicks is probably going to be back. Although, if Hicks doesn't come back, maybe, just maybe, they will slide Devondre to his position and give Simmons time. And if that's the case, there's a little bit of intrigue. Now, Jordan Phillips missing time, I hope it is a minor hamstring and that he can be back after the bye, because they need him. They need him they need his interior presence. Although, Lucky Fotu has been pleasantly surprising. After it looked like they were holding him out in the first couple of games, he's earned his playing time and he's making an impact, even if he's not, you know, putting up eye-popping numbers at all.
Yeah, and so when I look at it, I, you know, in my list of kind of descending order, I think for me it still comes out as Hicks is the most important. I don't know. I don't think that Simmons can do it. I think that you want to see him eased in and not forced in. And Miami has a good enough offense where they're worrisome. You know, the other ones are not concerning because of the equal talent with them. Does that make sense? Like,
yeah.
like you said, like Zach Allen, I think is a very good player and he's played well this year, but I don't see a huge drop off. Now it is getting concerning depth wise, because you're starting to go from, hey, I have really, you know, a lot of confidence in six or seven linemen, to, okay, we have confidence in five linemen now with both Rashad Lawrence and Zach Allen hurting. But, you know, at the end of the day, none of these guys are game changers to the point where you're like, oh man, this is a devastating, devastating loss for the team, especially with the guys that we're hoping they're going to be getting back.
Yeah,
this
getting
week.
Max Williams and Jalen Thompson back ideally. That's good. That's good, because because Deontay Thompson, you know, once they got past the Curtis Riley game, when it was the one game without Buda, Buda and Thompson have been pretty solid. And guess what, Jalen is a better tackler than Thompson. Deontay, DT likes to hit people, but he sometimes doesn't tackle as well. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out, and getting Max Williams back on the outside will be very, very nice.
Yeah, and I think you're getting closer to seeing kind of the vision this team had. I do feel bummed for Zach, because he was finally starting to kind of find his footing and play well and get consistent reps, and then for him to, you know, get nicked up again at a different position, or, you know, not at a different position, but get injured in a different way. It makes it tough, man.
It does. Coming up next on the Rise of the Red Podcast, the best star of Cardinal Stack. Let's wrap up this show. The trade deadline is next week. The Cardinals have already acquired one player in Marcus Golden. We didn't talk about that, did we? No. So Marcus Golden, been acquired by the Cardinals for a 6th-round pick. He comes back to the team that drafted him. But with the injuries, in particular running back, and some other concerns at some other positions, should they and could they make more moves? That's coming up next on Rise of C-Red. We're back on the Rise of C-Red podcast, the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Trade rumors, trade deadlines. The Cardinals were active a year ago. They got Kenyon Drake. That was a big addition. Last week, they added Marcus Golden. He will play his first game after the bye. First of all, since we didn't really talk about the trade, what do you think of it? And I almost think that the play that Reddick had might have been in part, you know how they always say your competition breeds, you know, what competition does. You trade for a guy in Marcus Golden who presumably is going to play for Hassan Reddick, and Hassan Reddick goes out and balls out.
Yeah, and you and I have talked off the air and in our group chats that I'd be offering Hassan Reddick a 2-year extension right now, because these guys get paid on the open market, and it's just one of those situations where he's producing at a level that coincides with his draft pick, and he's producing at a position that, you know, you and I have talked about this countless times, that is key to success on teams. When you have guys that rush the passer effectively, that's one of the most important positions in the NFL, and he's doing it at an extremely high level right now with 5 sacks on the season, already a career high. So he's on pace for double-digit sacks. He's playing a more effective coverage guy, which was expected, but after the first 3 years, I don't think we expected it this year. I think
it was like, you're like, he has the physical ability to cover these guys. He's never going to get it. But then we see him coming off, you know, whether he's rushing the passer or peeling off on a runner, he has been playing the outside backer position very well.
Yeah, he has, and he's been extremely effective, and he's a guy that, you know, it finally seems like it's starting to click for him. So you'd hate for him to end up getting displaced by Golden, who is an extremely effective pass rusher and a guy that, you know, can be used in conjunction with Hassan Reddick and Devin Kennard. And I think giving him a chance to continue to have positive success this season could end up being key to the future. As you and I kind of talked about off the air, his contract's obviously up at the end of this year. If you cannot get him to agree to a friendly deal, a friendly, 2-3 year, 15 to $25 million type of deal, where you're paying him, $7 to $8 million a year, then if he ends up with 12 sacks like he's on pace for and continues to play against the run better than we have expected and continues to take strides in coverage, you're talking about a complete player and a guy that could be worthy of a franchise tag, and people are going to say, whoa, you're going to pay him, what, $17.5 million or whatever it is? Well, ideally, no. But at the same time, it's 1 year. It's Chandler's last year, and you have a chance to kind of evaluate the future, if you will, as opposed to losing Hassan. Chandler comes back from a severe, you know, season-ending injury and maybe doesn't have the juice that he had in 2019 and 18 and 17 and 16 for the Cardinals, and all of a sudden you have no pass rusher. So, you know, it's just one of those things where I think you don't want to take him off the field now and expect, you know, Marcus Golden just to step in and produce, because while Golden's been effective as a pass rusher, he was displaced this year on the Giants because he didn't fit their new defensive scheme. That's why he was available more than anything.
As we look at other positions, there are some names that have come up. Obviously, Everson Griffin, he's off the board now, got traded to the Lions. A super intriguing name on the board that could be there is Quinnen Williams. That's, you know, that's, I don't know how much truth there are to the rumors, but maybe he could be had. Is there anyone out there the Cardinals should actually consider going? They've already traded away their fourth round pick that went away in the Hopkins deal, and now their sixth round pick for Golden. Is there anyone else that they should look at? Should they look at trading for a running back? I know someone on Twitter kind of floated how Duke Johnson might be a nice addition, but should they go out? Should they be active buyers at the deadline?
You know, and I go back to what we talked about a little earlier about positional importance. And I thought going after maybe a Yannick Ngakoue would have been a great fit when Chandler went down. They obviously didn't want to give up a third rounder, which is, I mean, understandable. They're probably not in the same window that the Ravens are to make a play like that. So, you know, it's understandable. So when you look at the positions, I'm not trading anything of value for a running back. I'm just not. I'm, you know, I already talked about it. I'm not a believer in it. Interior defensive line, Quinnen Williams has been good this year. I think that's a fair way to put it. He's been great at times, and he's been average to slightly below at times. So he's been good this year. I mean, he's still a young player with talent, you know. But I can't imagine that the Jets would honestly take anything less than a first-round pick for trading him away. So if you're going to give up a first-round pick, and if the rumors are true, and this is a big if, this is not Jess and I'm going to put all the caveats out there. It's not Jess and I reporting or, you know, saying any of that. If Stephon Gilmore or Xavien Howard are truly available, I think those are the only two players that I would actively shop for and then be willing to pay what the likely price would be. And the reason I say that is, one, obviously, positional importance. You know, we've talked about that quite a bit. Two, their age. They're both younger, or, you know, they're both in the kind of prime of their contracts. Xavien Howard's 27, just signed a new, you know, massive deal. So he's under control for a while. Gilmore is similar. I think he's a bit older. I think he's, what, 29 years old? But he, you know, again, you're looking at him, and are you, how long can you keep him for? He's 30. Wow, I didn't know he was that old.
30, yeah.
So maybe I wouldn't even trade for Stephon Gilmore. I mean, and it's not that that's old by any means. It's just, it seems like that's to move a team that is going all in this season would make. You know, he's got a very manageable cap hit next year. So maybe, I mean, maybe you can talk me into putting in a first for Gilmore. Howard, I don't think he's available. I think that got refuted already. But, you know, these other guys, Quinnen Williams, I like Quinnen Williams, don't get me wrong, but I'm not trading a first-round pick for him. And I don't think they're going to take anything else. And then I just don't know, I mean, are there any other names that are worth kind of talking? I mean, the Jets traded their other defensive lineman already too. So are they really going to trade both of them? So, it is the Jets. So let's.
I mean, people keep talking about like adding a true, like a good tight end, like Zach. Like, let's stop, guys. They don't throw to their tight ends. Everyone's been all in on Dan Arnold. What does he have? 6 catches this year? Like, they don't need a tight end. They need someone who can block. They're not going to
use right. Yeah, exactly. And that's you know, I think getting Max Williams back and then having, you know, these guys step up that are stepping up right now, I think they're just in a good spot. And, you know, unless you're going to get a guy that is a game changer, I don't think you're really looking at anything other than, you know, maybe basic type of moves, right?
Should they consider trading anyone they have on their roster to kind of – like Pat P, I think that'd be stupid to do right now, but he does have some trade value potentially. He's at a position of value. Is there anyone, because obviously they've already given up 2 of their picks. They might want to replenish that. Would you consider trading anyone?
No, because of where they're at right now, I think trading a player that is a starter would be incredibly disrespectful to the players that are on the team that would remain with the team. So if you trade Patrick Peterson, what kind of message are you sending to, you know, Kyler Murray? But more importantly, what message are you sending to guys like DeAndre Hopkins and Larry Fitzgerald? You know, if you trade Larry Fitzgerald, and not that they ever would, but like, you know, what message are you sending a guy like DeAndre Hopkins of, you know, like, oh, we want you to finish your career here. We just gave you this big contract, but you know, we want Larry to go win a Super Bowl this year. And DeAndre would be like, wait, so you're not planning on, I mean, you and I can have the conversation that they're probably not going to win the Super Bowl this season, but they should be looking at every move that they're making as, hey, we have a shot to win this year. I mean, they're 5-2. They're the 6th seed in the playoffs right now. Like, you've got to continue to look at it from that perspective, and give yourself a really good chance to be a team that makes noise in the playoffs. And you know, if you look at it, the 5 seed is probably the best seed to go into with the playoffs because you're going to get to play a team from the NFC East. Obviously, winning the division is, you know, the best, but you're probably going to get to play you're going to get to play a team from the NFC East, probably the Philadelphia Eagles. And, you know, that's then maybe you're not a team that's going to the Super Bowl in 2020, but maybe you're a team that's builds on, you know, a playoff victory for the first time in a lot of these players' careers, and that gives you a chance to continue to kind of grow and kind of move forward this year. If you were, you know, if you had lost that game and you're sitting at the 10 seed below San Francisco, I don't think I would be as opposed to selling some pieces, obviously not too much, but I think sitting at the 6th seed, the number 2 seed in the division, you know, a game out of first place in the division, I think you have to look at this as a team with a chance to make a statement this year. And you have to sell that to not only your fans, but you have to show your team that's what you believe.
Absolutely. And with that, we will wrap up this edition of the Rise of Sea Red podcast, episode 284. The Cardinals are off this week. It is their bye week. So next week's show, we will be back, and it will obviously not be reacted to a win or a loss. But we can kind of talk about, since it is week 8, it will be entering week 9, hitting the back end of the schedule. We can kind of do some midseason grades. We could talk about some other stuff, and that's what we do, and we'll look ahead to the Miami Dolphins. So wrapping up with this edition of the Rise Up Seared podcast, I'm Jess Root. That's Seth Cox. Thanks for listening, as always, and we will be back again next week. Thanks for listening to the latest edition of the Rise Up Seared podcast. Listen to previous episodes and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Audioboom, or many other podcast platforms so shows are delivered directly to your mobile device. Please give the show a 5-star rating and always support the sponsors who support the show. We'll be back soon for the best hour of Cardinals talk on the web. Rise up, Red Sea, be Red Sea Red, and of course, Rise Up, Sea Red.